Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, tariffs as ad copy.
And why the cultural conversation around manhood may be making things worse for everyone.
But first, the state Senate this week is poised to try to do something that hasn't been done in Arizona in more than four decades, override a gubernatorial veto. The bill in question would have prevented the Chinese government from buying land in Arizona. Similar kinds of laws have been approved in other states, but Governor Katie Hobbs vetoed the measure here last week. With me now, as he is every Monday during the legislative session, to talk about what to expect this week at the state capitol is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Good morning. You ask me that every week, and then every week you're disappointed that we haven't done much.
Well, this week, though, like there could, I mean, in theory, be some history. I mean, it's been a very, very long time since the legislature has overridden a veto.
It's been since like 1981 when some Democrats joined with Republicans to override a veto by Bruce Babbitt. You know, that was, you know, eight governors ago.
Yeah.
So that gives you some idea. This issue deals with a bill that started out originally as prohibiting people from certain enemy nations from owning land anywhere in Arizona. And the concern has to do with whether they would be spying or listening in, or maybe even just in a position to go ahead and do some sort of damage. By the time the bill got out of the House, it had been cut to something really simple. It says, the People's Republic of China may not own land in Arizona. Seems simple enough. And that's what went to the governor. I think what surprised a lot of people is the governor vetoed it. She gave a, I don't want to call it a poor explanation, but she said the legislation is ineffective at counter-espionage, does not directly protect our military assets, it lacks clear implementation criteria, and opens the door to arbitrary enforcement. Now, I don't know how much arbitrary you can do. If it's the People's Republic of China is on the deed, you can't own the land. Otherwise, you can. Now the governor is coming under a lot of scrutiny and a lot of calls, particularly like Senate President Warren Peterson, who said, we're going to try an override. The House did have sufficient votes with enough Democrats to override the governor. The Senate did not, even with this bill not really doing much of anything. So I'd say this is more of a political stunt, if you want to call it that, see if you can embarrass the governor. I'm counting on the governor between now and when the Senate comes in later this week to do some sort of massive defense and saying, well, here's the problem with it, and you really shouldn't override it, and here's why it isn't ineffective, even if the bill doesn't do much of anything. So it's going to be more political theater, I think, than actual legislation.
Interesting. So, Howie, the governor also has another fairly controversial bill on her desk dealing with teachers and anti-Semitism. And it seems as though there's a pretty substantial lobbying effort for her on both sides, both those who want her to sign it and those who want her to veto it.
Well, there's a lot of concerns given what's been happening since October 7th attack by Hamas against Israel, Israel's actions in Gaza. There have been a lot of anti-Semitic acts. You had a couple that was gunned down in Washington. You've had this crazy person in Boulder who was using Molotov cocktails to attack Jewish residents who were looking to help free the hostages. And so it's obviously very sensitive. The question becomes whether what is being proposed here is constitutional and well thought out. I mean, it would cement into Arizona law a definition of anti-Semitism that some folks have concern with. I mean, on one hand, you've got the low-hanging fruit. You shouldn't call for the eradication of Jews as a species. But then you get into some areas that could be considered, you know, First Amendment rights, like the criticism of Israel and whether what Israel is doing in Gaza is similar to what the Nazis did to the Jews. Now, you can have a lot of theories about that, but the other part of the problem that with the bill that a lot of folks are concerned about is it says that if you are a teacher, whether it's a university or a public school, and someone comes home and says, you know, Dad, I think teacher said something anti-Semitic, after going through a process of complaint, you actually can take the teacher to court civilly on a personal level, which means a teacher has to hire an attorney and could be personally liable.
Which is something that a lot of the Democrats who oppose this, or the members who oppose this, that was something that they were really concerned about, right?
Well, they're definitely concerned about it because of the fact that this isn't a question where normally, let's say you've got a problem with the sheriff's deputy and you sue the sheriff's department that defends the person,
right,
you know, as the employer. You've got some real issues, with the issue of personal liability there. But again, you come down to a question of where's the line. Now, as you pointed out, there are people on both sides of this. State school chief Tom Horn, who happens to be Jewish, said we really need some protections there. The things going on in classrooms, he cited an incident in Scottsdale where he said that there were a lot of pro-Palestinian things being said in an unbalanced fashion. But then if you've got not just the AEA, Arizona Education Association, concerned about teacher liability, but even the National Council of Jewish Women, who say this definition of anti-Semitism was never meant to be a campus speech guide, and you really should not put it into Arizona law.
All right, so Howie, just a little less than a minute left. I want to ask you about the future of the lawsuit that is challenging a few Arizona abortion-related laws after Attorney General Chris Mayes said she would not defend them. Will these laws get a defense as they move through the process?
Oh, they probably will. I think that House Speaker Steve Montenegro says he wants to. I mean, Prop 139, as we all know, that put a constitutional right to abortion in Arizona Constitution. These three laws, which have been on the books for a while, are having to do with like 24-hour waiting period and a ban on telemedicine for abortion, probably do not survive that, given the breadth of the constitutional amendment. But May said, I don't consider them to be constitutionally defensible. Steve Montenegro says they need to be defended.
All right. That is Howie Fisher with Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always.
Have a great day.
Tariffs have been a big topic of conversation, their potential impact on prices and the overall economy. But talk of tariffs is also showing up in places beyond just the news, including in commercials.
With all the uncertainty around tariffs, we wanted to remind drivers that many cars in our award-winning lineup are unaffected. That means our best-selling road, Frontier.
No tariffs. Ever.
You'll never pay extra due to tariffs when you purchase WeatherTech products because they've been proudly manufactured here in the USA for decades.
Which automaker employs the most hourly workers in the country? Ford. Which automaker assembles the most vehicles in the country? Ford. That's not a coincidence. It's a commitment.
Some companies have been including tariffs in their pitch to consumers, sometimes as a way to compare their prices to those of their competitors, and others as a way to point out their products are made in America. With me now to talk more about this is Tim Reister, founder and CEO of the Phoenix-based advertising firm Reister. Tim, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for being here. So, like, how prevalent is it that, you know, we just heard from a few commercials that have mentioned in one way or another tariffs. Like, how prevalent is this?
It's very prevalent right now, and made in America as a claim among advertisers isn't a new thing. This is something that interestingly began back in the late 1800s. The first documented usage was in San Francisco in the cigar industry, and Americans were concerned because of the mass immigration of Chinese residents who were moving to the United States, and they were afraid they were going to be able to make the products much more quickly and inexpensively. So they created a label that really was about prejudice. It was a white label, and it meant that the cigars were made by white people instead of by Chinese people. Hmm. And that evolved into the Made in America brand that over the years we've seen used periodically. It became very popular during World War II and after World War II. And then probably the greatest in modern history usage of Made in America was during the Reagan administration.
Yeah.
Even his campaign. Do you remember his campaign that it was called A New Day in America.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And it had the farmers and the sunrise. And that's the last time we've seen Made in America as prevalent as it's becoming now.
Are those a little bit different, though, in the sense that it seems to me anyway, as an outsider, that some of these companies are saying, you know, our products are made in America, which will save you money, as opposed to it's a pride thing. It's a patriotic thing.
Yeah. And I believe that advertisers need to be very careful right now in how they proceed in using these claims, really for two different reasons. We know that consumers place quality and convenience and price at the top of the list whenever they're making a purchase decision. And we know that the willingness to pay any more for a product just because it's made in America is very small.
Hmm.
So I think, and when you, even the ads that you were sharing in the preview for this segment aren't really getting into brand equity or reasons why, other than the threat of tariffs, that a product would be better or more advantageous for a consumer to purchase. So I think consumers are going to be smarter about this. They're not going to move to a product simply because they're concerned about a tariff. They're going to be looking at what they get for their money.
I also wonder if there's maybe a concern about reminding consumers about tariffs. Like, even if, you know, product X, you know, you can make the arguments a little bit cheaper, I would think, like, consumers in general might, you know, if you forget about it, you might be more willing to buy more things. And once you're reminded, oh, yeah, there are tariffs, things might be more expensive, you might shut down your purchasing, even of the product that's telling you they're cheaper because of tariffs.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mark. And there was a study last month from Gartner, and it found that 47% of U.S. consumers expect to buy more American-made products this year, particularly because of all the news surrounding tariffs.
Hmm.
And so there is a natural movement domestically due to the concern that's being elevated in the press. But conversely, the press and the up and down tariff war is really destroying the Made in America brand abroad. And another study that just came out last month showed a 20% decline in the international perceptions of America as quality. And I think that's really, you know, when we look at balancing the benefits of local interest within the United States in American-made products and the deterioration of the American brand abroad, it's really a difficult situation for advertisers to balance. And I think as we go forward, you might see vastly different types of ad messages from the same advertiser domestically versus what they're going to use internationally.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because it seems as though there's sort of like an implied, you know, quote unquote, made in America means quality. In addition to, you know, the patriotism and national pride and everything, it almost seems like there's an implicit, if it's made in America, it's going to be high quality. But as you're saying, other countries are looking at that and having almost the complete opposite reaction.
Indeed. And it's interesting because there are watchdog groups that are checking the facts in these claims. In the United States, the group is called the Federal Trade Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And if they find an untruth in an advertising claim surrounding Made in America products, per untruth or per misclaim, it's over $50,000 in
Wow.
fines. And we've seen a recent case with the largest fine in history was last year, Williams-Sonoma. And this really surprised me to learn it was Williams-Sonoma, because they have developed such a high perception of their products and their brand.
Mm-hmm.
In 2020, they were given a warning from the Federal Trade Commission for breaching and misquoting a claim about American made. And they made the mistake again in 2023 and had to pay $3.1 million in fines.
Wow. That's a lot. All right. We'll have to leave it there, unfortunately. That is Tim Reister, founder and CEO of the advertising firm here in Phoenix, Reister. Tim, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Have a great day.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how nationwide economic uncertainty could affect Arizona.
But first, as illustrated by last week's emotionally charged falling out between President Trump and his so-called first buddy, Elon Musk, there's been a lot of talk recently about the relationship between manhood and power. Late last year, the show's senior producer, Nick Sanchez, and I went to America Fest, the annual convention thrown by Charlie Kirk's political organization, Turning Point USA. And as we were driving back to the station afterwards, we found ourselves marveling at the content of what we'd heard from the speakers at the event, or perhaps more accurately, what we hadn't heard. America Fest took place just a few weeks after the presidential election, and we were both expecting the litany of conservative influencers and politicians to talk about inflation and border issues, things that, at that point in the postmortem cycle, many pundits were saying had motivated Trump voters. But those issues barely came up at America Fest. What Kirk and his fellow speakers seemed much more interested in talking about was masculinity and why, according to them, it is under attack. Since that night, here at the show, we've been taking note of the wide range of cultural debates we're seeing about men's roles and behaviors. And whether or not you agree with Charlie Kirk's point of view on it, it seems hard to dispute the idea that masculinity as we know it is changing somehow. So what are those changes? Why do they matter? And how does this moment of gender discourse differ from previous eras? This week on the show, we're going to bring you a collection of conversations about those questions and more. But to start, we thought we'd take you back to that night at America Fest when we started asking them. America Fest is many things: a gathering of high school and college activists, a pop-up market for health supplements that list things like patriotic spirit and godly devotion on their ingredient labels, and above all, a four-day victory lap. On the first night of America Fest, a crowd of thousands swarmed the main hall at the convention center to watch a 20-minute hype video celebrating Turning Point's impact on the 2024 election.
Young men are now more conservative than they have been in 50 years. You can make the case we will win.
At the end of the video, the lights went out. And then a picture of Turning Point founder Charlie Kirk flashed on screen.
The single most effective organizer of conservatives in the United States.
One of the most formidable.
Chest-rattling house music erupted from the speakers. The crowd went wild. Kirk appeared in silhouette behind a baffle and then strolled out on stage, his arms stretched wide.
Welcome to America Fest, everybody.
After a confetti cannon went off and the thank you, Charlie chants died down, Kirk launched into a stemwinder. By the grace of God Almighty, he told the crowd, America had survived the Biden administration. The last 4 years, he declared, had been an embarrassment. But not, it would seem, because of expensive groceries or gas prices. In fact, Kirk barely talked about the economy or the border, which garnered only passing mention and even then only tepid applause.
To see our taxpayer dollars being sent to Ukraine while our southern border remains wide open. Donald Trump loved his nation so much so that he...
What troubled Charlie Kirk most, it seemed, was the loss of our national virility.
We're sick and tired of hearing about toxic masculinity when we are drowning in toxic femininity. When we become a feelings-based culture, you can't say that, you can't do that, but you're going to offend somebody. And who is the most overtly masculine political figure of the last 100 years? It's the man who would never apologize for America. That isn't
for Charlie Kirk, the re-election of Donald Trump was a return to American masculinity.
And in many ways, this was an election that was more about culture than it was about politics. That it was about who are we as a people.
In Kirk's ideal world, We are a people unmoved by feelings. Ironically, moments after he said that, the crowd rose to its feet as he began denouncing trans people.
We need to end the medical mutilation of our children called gender-affirming care.
And it was here, when Kirk started shouting about gender, that the applause became anything but tepid. It was deafening.
No men in women's sports. Controversial thing to say 3 or 4 years ago. It took a little bit of a masculine chip on the shoulder to say, no, actually, I'm not going to allow that to happen. You see, they wanted us to be quiet and afraid and silent and subservient.
I will admit, when I heard this, I couldn't help thinking that having a masculine chip on the shoulder sounds a lot like men having hurt feelings. But that, evidently, is not what Charlie Kirk meant. For him, the problem was other people's feelings.
Young men want to be part of a political movement that doesn't hate them. In fact, let me go a step further, that thinks they're essential to a future of a country. That we need strong.
In the convention hall, after Kirk's speech, I tracked down some of these young men. Meet Owen.
Yeah, I run the Turning Point USA chapter at Florida State University.
And James.
I'm a Turning Point ambassador, and I also run my own social media, conservative influencer type things.
Owen and James are both in their 20s. They were both wearing suits, and like Charlie Kirk, they were both in a panic about gender.
You know, a male holds open the door, and it's like, well, a woman could do it on her own. Well, I just want to be a nice person and hold open the door. It's not that I think a female can't hold the door for herself. It's just, I want to be nice.
Why, James lamented, won't women just let him be nice? Why must they assume that his attempts at chivalry are in fact an attempt to belittle them?
So how I look at it is, and the reason you have this red pill movement is because young men have felt forgotten.
There they are again, those pesky emotions. I asked James if he agreed with Charlie Kirk that we shouldn't be a nation based on feelings. But once again, it seemed I was missing the point. Men's feelings weren't the problem.
That feeling comes from action towards men. So when you say, hey, okay, you can put a male in a dress and he's now female. And if a male wants to paint his nails, if we say, hey, that's not what men do. Men need to be strong so they can protect their family and work hard and build a long-lasting legacy. Then they attack that. So,
but I just have to say, I think the pushback to that would be that if a man decides they want to wear a dress and identify as a woman, that doesn't necessarily mean they can't work hard or protect their family.
I think when you allow those gender roles, or specifically those two things, to be misconstrued, in my personal opinion, that diminishes masculinity and that diminishes malehood.
Owen agreed. Malehood is under attack, as is femalehood.
With women, you have the masculinization of them. You say, you know, especially with young women, go to college, go get a job, prioritize these things, these individual interests over family creation, you know, relationships, connections, things like that.
But is that inherently masculine to go to college and have a job?
I would say that in order to provide for a family, you know, the purpose of having a job, getting an education, is, you know, the ability to provide for a family, to provide for something greater than yourself. And I think if a man tried to argue that that's masculinity, that's completely wrong. The inversion of gender roles is really the biggest problem that we're actually having. And it's confusing young people, and it's how you end up with men wearing dresses.
I'm not sure I followed Owen's logic there, or James's, for that matter. But I also can't blame them for being confused. They both told me that they grew up without fathers. And that, they said, is one of the things that draws them to men like Donald Trump and Charlie Kirk, and the man who closed out night one of America Fest, Tucker Carlson.
Thank you! That is amazing. Thank you very much! Thank you!
After another blast of confetti from on high, Carlson gave a meandering speech that called for isolationist foreign policy, vaccine skepticism, and the end of abortion rights. He paused periodically to stuff a nicotine pouch into his lip. And like Charlie Kirk, Carlson's message was fueled by a kind of patriarchal grievance. At one point, he urged the crowd to hold centrist Republicans accountable.
And anyway, just make them obey. I think that's up to us. Don't be charmed by them. Force them. Spank them like the bad little girls they are. Thank you.
Towards the end of the speech, Carlson opened the floor for questions. A young man with dimples and a sharp jawline approached the mic.
So, hi, Tucker. My name's Jake. My question is about nicotine.
Yeah.
So, I see your little packet. I don't know if that's Zyn or Alp, but from what I hear, you know, nicotine comes with a bunch of benefits. Increasing testosterone. Love that. So, it's my 16th birthday today, and when did you start taking nicotine, and would you recommend taking nicotine?
Carlson would indeed recommend it.
I'm just telling you what worked for me. I don't drink or use drugs of any kind, including Advil, and I haven't for 22 years. I don't put any chemicals in my body whatsoever other than nicotine and black coffee, and I feel great. I do.
I couldn't find Jake in the crowd after Carlson's speech, which is too bad. I wanted to know what he thought of Tucker's answer. After all, it's just how he feels.
How do you feel? How do you feel? How do you feel?
With the nature of masculinity up for debate, there's been a widely reported cultural resurgence of a very particular form of male identity. It has various manifestations, but from social media influencers to politicians, men are being subjected to a steady stream of messaging that the key to reclaiming their primacy in American life has something to do with a return to a hyper-traditionalist, patriarchal version of manhood. Sarah Jones is a writer for New York Magazine, and she wrote about this recently. Her piece is called "Masculinity Will Not Save Men." And she says this is not a new phenomenon. And moreover, she told me, it's not helping anyone.
I don't think turning to what we call traditional masculinity, this notion of like male heroism and chivalry, is really the answer. I think for men in particular, it's just another political dead end.
Yeah, another critical point that you raise that doesn't get talked about very much in these ongoing conversations about the fallout from the masculinity crisis is that it also opens this lane for hucksters to sell these highly suspicious like supplements and stuff to men based on the idea that it will open a pathway for them to return to this hierarchical position that they're supposedly born to.
Yes, and I find that so interesting, not least because there is sort of a mirror phenomenon among women, especially online and in social media.
Uh-huh.
Where, you know, I run into it all the time. I'll just be scrolling Instagram and someone's trying to sell me a juice cleanse and, you know, help me get in touch with the divine feminine or whatever. But there is a kind of a corresponding notion of that for men too. You know, kind of dubious supplements that are supposed to make you as like swollen, as masculine as possible.
Yeah. Well, we were talking before we got on the line about both growing up in Virginia. And one of the things I remember from being around conservative men when I was younger is that the way that it manifested was much more, and I'm speaking very generally here, of course, but it manifested a lot in a foregrounding of vice, I would call it. So steakhouse culture was very big, martini culture, having a big belly and talking about, you know, being a womanizer and smoking cigars and stuff. These, the sort of Rush Limbaugh version of conservative masculinity. Whereas this newer strain that you're referencing seems much more about a kind of austerity model.
It's very much about wellness, and I would argue that exists for a lot of different reasons. You can trace it back to maybe New Age spirituality as far back as the 70s and 80s. You know, I grew up evangelical. I would see traces of this and, growing up.
You talk about seeing some of the origins of it in the Promise Keepers movement. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So the Promise Keepers were very big in the 90s and I think through the early 2000s, and it was founded by a football coach at the University of Colorado.
There's a dynamic that takes place when men and boys come together in the name of Jesus Christ that electrifies. It so pleases the heart of God that we come in the name of His Son, because you see, it's always been mandated by God that the spiritual leaders would be the men.
There were a couple of interesting features about it. One was kind of about getting in touch with your emotions almost in a way and sort of bonding with other men. And they were very clear that this was a very anti-gay thing. In some corners of evangelicalism, if you look at the ex-gay movement in particular, the idea that by bonding with other men in a heterosexual and, like, by their definition, sort of spiritual way, that it was almost an antidote to homosexuality.
Yes. Well, it makes me think of a lot of the male bonding camps.
Yes.
You know, they all have these kind of opaque names like the True Path or like the, you know, the Brotherhood of the Temple Keepers or I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Who is True North Men's Development Camp for?
This is not for the faint at heart. This is not for somebody who doesn't want to change.
True North is about having an internal compass.
It's for men that achieve some level of success, but they know that there's another level they want to earn.
Knowing the Creator, knowing your path.
It is often marketed as a kind of, to go back to what you were saying, a new age sort of evolved perspective on masculinity and the responsibilities that come along with it. But as we're talking, I'm realizing that foundational to those ideas is still this very old-fashioned, arguably backwards idea that men are supposed to be at the top of the hierarchy and need to regain some connection with that.
Your strength as a man comes from looking at this mountain and the people that live in this mountain, your wife, your kids, your employees. Those people are the people of your mountain.
One of the criticisms of it that I think may be borne out is, are you really helping men by telling them to get in touch with their masculinity in this way? Is there really a way to do that that does not just reinforce traditional gender roles? And I'm not sure. Like, I think about the notion of kind of the male breadwinner, the man being a provider for his family. Like, I don't, to be clear, I think taking care of the people you love is a very good impulse, and we should celebrate that.
Of course.
But the notion of being a provider, being the breadwinner, then I think that's where that element of control starts to sneak in. So it's very complicated.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And you're making me think, as we're talking about this, that whether it's the Promise Keepers movement kind of identifying homosexuality as the threat to masculinity, or the Trump administration identifying DEI as the threat to masculinity, all of those ignore what you're arguing is the fundamental problem, which is, I believe you refer to it as a broken political economy.
I want to be clear. When I talk about a broken political economy, I say this in the piece, but I think, you know, you could burn down capitalism tomorrow and there would still be misogyny. Misogyny is much older than capitalism. But I do think when we're talking about this search for purpose and meaning among men and among women too, you have to consider the context, and that's taking place within this political economy that, in my view anyway, does encourage exploitation and is violent and sort of encourages ruthless behavior, you know, traits that are stereotypically masculine, and not in the way where you're taking care of your loved ones, right? Like, this is something that's far more brutal. You have somebody like Trump who's at the top of the ladder, and maybe people look at him and think, if I'm violent enough and I push enough people out of my way, maybe I can climb the ladder too.
And one of the other things that you point out that I think is critical here is that there is a kind of perverse honesty to the brutality that people like Trump are saying is necessary, because that's what it's taken for them to get to the top of that ladder. But that brutality is not a substitute for building a new ladder.
No, it's not. I'm thinking of a tweet that I saw today by a right-wing man who I think he works on Matt Gaetz's new show. And he was talking about tariffs, but in his view, tariffs are really good for men because they're going to go back to manufacturing and their place in the factory, and they're not going to compete with women for jobs anymore, which means women, of course, will go back in the kitchen and make sandwiches, and fertility rates will go up, and everything's going to be beautiful, at least for men. So it is very much wrapped into this, like, very, very, like, market-based, very economic picture of who gets to be on top.
There's, like, a hint of Gilded Age kind of, you know, robber baron capitalism nostalgia attached to this, like, pining for the glory days of the assembly line.
Right, there is. And that was an era before, you know, what we think of today as organized labor, at least. Certainly an era before civil rights, an era before feminism. You know, it was an era where power was even far more brutal than it is now. And I don't think that's a coincidence.
Yeah, yeah. It's a time when people were like dying in coal mines and, you know, getting sucked into welding machines and that kind of thing.
Right, right.
Well, Sarah Jones is a senior writer for Intelligencer at New York Magazine, and we have been discussing Sarah's piece, Masculinity Will Not Save Men. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Over the weekend, we saw another round of fatal attacks at U.S.-Israeli-run food distribution centers in Gaza. At least four people are said to have been killed on Sunday. Joining us now with an update, as well as a roundup of some other major stories around the world, is the BBC's Pete Ross. Pete, what's the latest out of Gaza?
Yeah, as you say, Sam, at least four Palestinians reported to have been killed at an aid distribution center run by an Israeli and US-backed organization known as the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. It's been running for about 2 weeks or so now since Israel ended its months-long blockade on all aid into Gaza. It's just the latest in a number of violent incidents that have occurred at these centers. They temporarily closed down for more than 24 hours last week in response to these, and it's another tragic event that's taken place over the weekend. However, as I'm speaking to you today, there's another story that seems to be grabbing the international headlines at the moment. That's the Freedom Flotilla yacht, the private yacht, the Madeleine, crewed by around 12 volunteers, including the climate activist Greta Thunberg and a French lawmaker that's been trying to reach the Gaza Strip for the last few days. Earlier today, Israeli forces say they've intercepted the yacht that was carrying a small amount of aid, and it's now making its way back to Israel. The Freedom Flotilla Coalition says it works to, quote, end the illegal Israeli blockade of Gaza, and that the Madeleine ship was carrying a symbolic quantity of aid, including rice and baby formula. So at the moment, the main news is that aid is still a big issue around getting into Gaza, and it's still only being let in limited amounts. So I think the main thing to watch out for this week is how much aid is getting in and exactly who's distributing it.
All right, Pete. Well, let's move to France now, where the 2025 UN Ocean Conference begins today. This is said to be the largest event of its kind ever organized, and it aims to get countries to commit to new plans to protect the world's oceans. What can you tell us about this one?
Yeah, this Oceans Conference is the third of its kind, and it was called after the UN issued a warning, the United Nations issued a warning saying the world sea was facing an unprecedented crisis. So it's open today, and it's hoped, I guess, analysts would say, that the summit will provide a vital chance for key agreements to be finalized and promises to be delivered upon and new pledges to be made. Top of the agenda is something called the High Seas Treaty. Now, that's a landmark international accord aimed at protecting marine life in the two-thirds of the ocean that lie outside national boundaries. These areas, known as the High Seas, hence the High Seas Treaty, have historically been largely unregulated, making them vulnerable to exploitation, pollution, and the impacts of climate change. Now, back in March of 2023, something known as the High Seas Treaty was agreed upon after nearly two decades of negotiations, and it was formally adopted by the United Nations General Assembly in June of 2023. However, since then, in order for that to become legally binding and enter into force, it must be ratified by 60 member states. And in the run-up to this, in the last 2 years, only a couple of states have pledged to do just that. Now, according to French President Emmanuel Macron, more than 50 countries in the last few hours today have submitted ratifications to the UN Ocean Conference. So they'll be hoping to go through those and to get some sort of declaration that they'll be able to sign by the end of the summit, which ends on Friday.
All right. Well, finally today, Pete, the annual G7 leaders meeting begins in Canada on Sunday. In addition to the leaders of the G7 member states, several invited world leaders include Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky and India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, both expected to attend. What is likely to be on the agenda?
Yes, the latest G7, annual G7 Leaders Summit begins in Alberta in Canada on Sunday. Now, as the host nation, Canada has announced its priorities ahead of the summit, focusing on three core missions: protecting our communities in the world, building energy security, and accelerating the digital transition, and securing the partnerships of the future. Now, in addition to those, let's be honest, very broad themes, I think we can also expect discussions on global economic stability and climate action, which are also very broad themes. So let's look at some specifics that might come up on the agenda. And I think we could look at some of the world leaders outside of the G7 that have been invited. You mentioned them in your question there. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, we've been told, will attend. I'm not sure if that's going to be in person or by video link, but that will certainly mean that the ongoing war in Ukraine will be front and center. You also mentioned Indian President Narendra Modi, and that's pointing to a bit of controversy, because when the Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney extended the invitation to his Indian counterpart, this has sparked significant criticism, particularly from within Canada's Sikh community. Tensions between India and Canada escalated dramatically back in 2023 after Canadian authorities, including the former Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, publicly accused agents of the Indian government of involvement in the assassination of a Canadian citizen and prominent Sikh separatist leader, Singh Nijjar. So this invitation from Mark Carney has come as a bit of a surprise to some, but also points perhaps to some warming in relations, though do expect some protest, particularly from the Canadian Sikh community.
All right. Well, a tremendous amount to keep an eye on this week. That is the BBC's Pete Ross keeping us in the loop, as always. Pete, thank you so much.
Always great to be with you, Sam. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. There has been a lot of economic uncertainty over the past several months, both here in Arizona and around the country. Questions about the impacts of tariffs, increased immigration enforcement, and tax policy have led to questions about how the economy will respond. A recent headline on an economic report from the University of Arizona says, Arizona's economy hits turbulence. George Hammond is director of the Economic and Business Research Center in the Eller College of Management at the U of A. He wrote that report and joins me to talk about it. And George, how would you right now describe the state of Arizona's economy?
Arizona's economy is growing. We're adding jobs, population, income. But particularly for jobs, the job growth last year especially was unusually slow at 1.3%. That was equal to the national average, and it was the slowest rate of growth that we've seen in Arizona since 2011, when we were coming out of the Great Recession. Job growth was even slower in Tucson. Actually, we saw net job losses over the year in Tucson with a decline of just over 2,000. So overall, the state's still growing, but we lost some momentum last year, that's for sure.
Why do you think it is that job growth was slower last year than it had been?
Well, that's a bit of an open question. I think it probably boils down to the all of that federal fiscal stimulus that was flowing through the economy as we came out of the pandemic, finally is completely out of the system.
Yeah.
And, you know, that left the state in a little bit of a doldrums.
Well, so given that that money is likely not coming back, is, as you described it, the doldrum sort of the new normal?
I think we're in the same kind of situation in 2025, although for different reasons. I think we'll see growth this year in the state economy, but I think it's going to be slow. I think job growth in 2025 statewide is going to be about the same that we saw in 2024, and I think what's driving that in large part is the macroeconomic policy uncertainty that's being driven by the current federal administration, you know, over things like tariff policy, like, you know, mass deportations, the federal spending and job cuts.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that because, you know, we've been hearing obviously about some of the challenges that policymakers, state lawmakers are having in terms of trying to craft a new state budget, not necessarily knowing how much money they'll have to work with because of some of that uncertainty coming from Washington, D.C. When you look at the overall state economy, how much does that level of uncertainty factor in?
It factors in a lot. You know, Arizona is subject to those same uncertainties that are affecting the national economy. And just like people all around the country and to some extent all around the world, you know, when the economic policy environment or the macroeconomic environment is particularly uncertain, both firms, businesses, and individuals and households tend to hold back on making big purchases like, you know, investing in plant and equipment or, you know, buying a new car in the case of households. And it's that lack of spending that tends to lead to a slowdown in economic activity. And that's what I think we're going to see through the second half of 2025.
Inflation has been such a big topic of conversation over the past few years. It seems as though that's maybe not such as big a concern in parts of Arizona as it has been in the past. Is that fair?
Yes. Inflation is one of the good news stories in the current performance statewide. Phoenix is where we have data, but I think we're seeing the same trends across the state. But Phoenix inflation has been below the national average for about the past year and a half. Consumer prices in Phoenix were barely up over the year in April, and they were up 2.3% nationally. We have seen some firming in consumer commodities prices. So there, think of new and used autos, gas, food, appliances, apparel. And I think we're going to see those prices rise at a somewhat faster pace going through the rest of 2025 as the tariffs really start to bite.
Let's talk about tariffs for a second, because, you know, going back to some of that uncertainty, is it possible to sort of project out what the impact of tariffs might be on Arizona's economy when we don't really know what the tariffs are going to be, much less what their effects might be?
Well, this is a common situation for forecasters. We have to make some guesses about what the policy will be going forward. And, you know, there's no shortage of those sorts of projections for the national economy. But, you know, if the tariffs that are currently being discussed and are currently in place, you know, actually come to fruition, we're looking at accelerating inflation, you know, probably not anywhere near the rates of inflation that we saw coming out of the pandemic. And we're looking at significantly, you know, slower U.S. real GDP growth, and that will, you know, that will flow down to the state as well. So, you know, tariffs are a drag going forward, but it's really the uncertainty about the tariffs and the impact that has on current spending by businesses and consumers that's really the big concern.
Sure. How much does consumer sentiment matter in all of this? I mean, we've seen, you know, consumer confidence surveys from the University of Michigan show that people don't feel all that great about the economy. Like, how much does that matter in terms of the actual performance of the economy?
It can matter quite a bit. How people feel about the economy affects their spending decisions. If they feel confident about how things are going and how things will go in the future, they're a bit more likely to make some of those large spending commitments. Same for businesses, but it's not everything. You know, the vibes can be significantly negative, and you know, if people actually look at their budgets and see that the facts look pretty strong, then they're more likely to engage in that kind of a spending, even though their worries may be a bit elevated. So, you know, we have seen big declines in consumer sentiment related to what's going on with federal economic policies. But we'll have to see how that translates into the kind of the hard data as we go through the next couple of months.
Okay. So, George, before I let you go, I've got to ask you about the R word, because there's been so much talk over the last however many months it's been about, is a recession on the horizon? Is it not? If it is, how big of one will it be? What does your gut say right now? What do your forecasts show in terms of whether or not the U.S. might be headed toward a recession?
Well, our forecasts assume that the odds still favor continued growth. So we give our baseline forecast a 50% probability. A recession scenario, we give a 35% probability. And we, you know, we still hold out hope that there's a 15% chance that things will be even better than we think under the baseline. And kind of the story of our baseline forecast is that, you know, after 2 years of subpar growth here in Arizona, last year and this year, we really get back on track in 2026 and 2027.
That is George Hammond, director of the Economic and Business Research Center at the Eller College of Management at the University of Arizona. George, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Mark.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. For Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.